In a world of stereotypes, being called a geek comes with a certain image.
There is still that ingrained thing within me that is a little bit embarrassed about it.
In reality, geek culture has never been more mainstream, and behind every geek is a real story.
My dad was the one who got me into Star Wars and things.
Join me, your super dummy Paul, as I continue my learning experience and talk to the real people.
I'm a secondary school teacher, so I teach 11 to 16-year-olds in English.
Hear their stories exclusively on Fantastic Universes.
He's one of them, like, you're ever going to grow up? And I'm like, no, why should I? I like my life. I enjoy what I do. This is my hobby.
Available on all your favourite podcast catchers.
Welcome to the new era of Indie Comic Spotlight, where I, your host, Tony Farina, will be joined once a month by my co-host and good friend from Season's Greetings. Jack will be a monthly co-host on Indie Comic Spotlight, and this is his first appearance. And so, true to form, we've decided to stay in the Buffyverse. Let's not get too crazy right away. So, Jack, Absolutely. Thank you for being here.
Of course. I mean, it's a privilege. I apologize to all your listeners that now have to hear me again. But I'm really excited because, as you know, I like to read along with as much as I can of what you cover. Now I can actually get ahead because I'm going to be talking about it. Rather than like, oh, no, that's coming up this week, so I better read it in the next day. So I can plan ahead a little bit. And also, there's so many indie comics which I've either read in the past and want to reread or I want to read that I can now push to the top of the list because of this.
Yeah, because you have a reason to. It's funny how I feel the same way, like the stuff, because my other monthly co-host will be your sister and your co-host on the Nevers Season's Greetings spinoff show, Rhea. So it's just, we're keeping it all in the family. But she, with the book that I had her read, it was something that I'd not finished. So I was like, hey, and she was like, yeah, I'll read that. I mean, it's Kelly Sue plus.
Yeah, I started reading it today, actually.
Crazy, right? That'll be next week on this show. It will be deadly with Rhea. Yeah, it's Kelly Sue's quite the writer. Boy, she does not pull a lot of punches. So this is, I think, a real honest book that we're going to do today. So I'm really excited to have you here. I think this is great for me personally to have some consistency schedule-wise. Also, I know we get along really well and we're going to have we don't always have the same opinion. So I think that matters. And because it's a deep dive show and we're not just, you know, that having the differing opinions, I think gives us a deeper dive. If we're just super awesome, then, and you know, I feel like super awesome is going to come up several times throughout the course of this book discussion because it's fucking super awesome. But so very excited about this. So here we are. We are sticking to the Slayerverse, the 8-issue too short of a run Dark Horse comic Frey, which is the future Slayer. For whatever weird reason, Marvel didn't buy this, so you can still get this the other Buffy Dark Horse stuff, Boom. 8, 9, and 10, Boom must be doing a repackage because you cannot get them. They're unavailable unless you physically own them. But I have season 8, you've got season 8. So eventually we'll get to season 8. So we'll be okay there. But anyway, so Frey, let's go back in our time machine, 2001. Did you read Frey in real time?
No. 2001 is around my like out of buying comics phase, which I know we've discussed before, particularly on my debut on your show. So no, I didn't know this existed. I don't think until probably a few years later. So until it was packaged into a graphic novel, certainly. But I think about 2005, 2006 is when I really got back into buying comics and buying monthlies as well. So this would have been on a stand that I would have stumbled across. What about you? Fair.
Yeah, nope, same. I was one of those ones where, because same for me. So 2001, so my two kids are born in 99 and 2000. They're Irish twins, actually. So in March of 99, Emma was born. And in March of 2000, Rachel was born. And then I was divorced from their mother by like 2002. And so 2003. So there was that stretch from like 99 to 2002, 2003, where I was not
going to happen.
I had two little kids. I had a stepdaughter. My ex-wife has an older daughter, Alex. Hey, Gator. I call her Gator. I actually just got to see her recently when I was up in Michigan. So that was cool. So we were busy. We had two kids that were essentially the same age and a four-year-old. So it was like comic books, but that wasn't a thing. So, but I was aware of it because my friend Heath was always aware of things. So he was kind of like in the early, and the internet was a thing by then too. So that helped. And we had dial-up through my work, through where I taught. We got a free dial-up number, which was amazing. And honestly, who, like, if you didn't have the internet and then you had dial-up, it was amazing. Right?
There's certain things about, you know, obviously it was shit compared to what we've got now, but yeah. I mean, it was amazing for the time.
It was amazing. Yeah.
But it's one of those things which I don't know whether, you know, it's true or not. You know, like when I had a Spectrum, like I loved that loading noise. And dial-up has that, like, that tone as it's absolutely. And that noise is in my head. I remember that noise forever. So, it felt exciting.
It did. And it was, I would log in, the kids would be asleep. I'd be, you know, whatever. I wasn't much of a sleeper then. And I would get online and I would, you know, just hunt comic book sites and, like, keep up and try to read, you know, go to the previews website and see what was. So I was aware of it. But it wasn't until I got divorced and I was living on my own and before I met Lee, the girls and I was broke, man. And I was an adjunct professor. I was working at, you know, doing construction. I was doing whatever I could do. So the library, man, we'd go to the library and they would get DVDs and they would get books and we would get comics. So that's when I finally read it, was when it was, you know, put together. And this was like the time too, when that started to happen regularly. It was always like a one-off where it would either a stand like Dark Knight, Returns was always going to be collected, but it was before they started to collect running series. And at the time you weren't sure this was going to be, you thought this was going to be a running series, which it ultimately ended up not being. So it was a few years later, but it was also just the sweet spot for they're like, let's just start bundling all the comics we've ever had together. And it was like trades A+. So that was when it was for me, the mid aughts, I guess.
Yeah. So similar time for me, I think. Yeah, like I said, because I mean, to stay in universe again, it was Buffy season 8 that drew me into buying monthlies again. When I saw that was coming out, I was like, right, well, I'm getting my ass to a comic shop. And then once you're in there, there's that and there's that and there's that. So
I bought it was season 8. I would take the girls in and we would get all the covers, because remember there were multiple covers for each issue. So I did it all for a while, and then eventually I was like, I cannot do this. Did you get all the covers too?
I used to get a couple for Buffy. I got all the ones in the first Firefly run.
Yeah.
Because I wanted every character.
Right.
Yeah. But again, same as you, I reckon I maybe lasted a dozen Buffy issues. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is crazy.
Yeah. And then you're like, I'll just get whatever the one is.
Yeah.
Whatever. I'll just get one. Yeah. Did you get the drawn one or the one with the actors on it?
Always drawn. Yeah.
I like that one too. And it's nice to see them, but because you're like, I like this version of them too, for sure.
Agreed.
Yeah. So the plot of Frey is essentially sometime in the future, a new Slayer is born and wackiness ensues. Is that fair?
It is fair, because what I think I like about the opening of this is that it's not obviously interconnected for quite a while. You know, obviously there's hints, and obviously most people that are picking up are probably picking up because it's got Whedon's name on it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it was promoted, but it was promoted as like as a future Sarah Watt, because it doesn't really come in until the end of issue one. So you can almost read the whole of the first issue, because I mean, the side that's on the cover didn't exist in Buffy at this point.
No, right.
It's in Frey first.
Right. It exists here first before they bring it there. So smart. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, I'd be interested to do a bit of research, which, you know, lazy me hasn't done, about how they promoted this and whether they did say, you know, read the adventures for the future Slayer, because, yeah, it doesn't come in. You think it might be page one, which in a way it is, because it's kind of a powers that be, a demon powers that be talking to kind of a watcher, but without it being obvious, without it being, you know, old white guys sitting in a room.
Right. Well, and that's just it. In the original cover, issue one, cover one, there is no sign. That's on the collected edition. So she's like in a very, it's a Frank Miller Daredevil kind of look. She's on the edge of a building and there's monster
with the laser gun.
It looks more Blade Runner. Absolutely. And it says like from the creator, but who cares? That doesn't mean anything, right? It's like, if you're saying, you know, from the creator of It, by Stephen, you know what I mean? It's like, yes, The Body is also written by Stephen King, but that's Stand By Me. That's also from the creator of It. So just seeing that it's from the creator of doesn't mean anything. So I think it was smart, but it probably did hurt it.
Yeah. Was he writing X-Men by now? I don't know when his Astonishing X-Men run started.
I thought, was that while he was still doing Buffy? Was he doing
this? Might be his first. So, yeah, I think this is probably his first comic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And he was always into comics, obviously.
Yeah.
And the intro to this about him talking about comics is in the collected edition. You know, he gets into that whole idea of how comics work. And so, So I think it was, it definitely starts off with Bang. And it is cool that it's in universe, but not in universe. But and it takes a while. So I think that's a smart slow burn thing. My first big thing that I want to talk about is the title, because our character is Malacafrey, but the book title is just called Frey. And as that unfolds, spoilers, everybody, we're going to spoil this 20 year old book, okay? So just hang on. If you haven't read Frey, pause, go find it, come back, and then continue to listen to us, because we're going to spoil it. There's three characters who are Freys. So what did you make? I think that makes it cooler that it's a story in the Buffyverse, in the vampire, in this Watcherverse, it's like Frey is, because when you first read it, you're like, oh, her name is Frey. What a cool, badass name. And you're like, Malacca, that's a cool name too. But it's like Frey is a family name, and it kind of gives them this commentary on the whole family angle that the Buffy universe is always about, is like, the Summer's name means something, but of course Dawn's not a real person and Joyce dies. And so Buffy builds her own family, but this is truly a family. So I don't know, what did you make of the fact that there's, as you're reading it, that it's not just a Slayer story, but it is like a family drama too.
No, that's really interesting. I mean, I guess it could have been called, you know, Malacca the Vampire Slayer, couldn't it? Malacca the Lurk Slayer, if they wanted.
The Lurk Slayer, right, yeah.
I mean, Frey sounds a lot cooler. I agree.
Super cool.
I think, I think it's a title that does draw you in. And I think it's, as you said, it reveals as you go that really you're looking at a three-pronged kind of narrative, aren't you? As you said, about like this family and this one key event that has affected them all and taken them down a certain path until they all come together in issue 8. But I think, obviously, there's the meaning of the word Frey as well, the idea of like, you know, their family ties have been frayed, but also it has a kind of futuristic sound to it as well, in a way, when you think about the world that it's in. I think it's a very cleverly picked title. Yeah, I don't really have anything too deep to say, if I'm honest.
No, that's totally fair. I just thought, I just think it's I like it when thing, of course, this is my thing. I heard you and Mike talking about me, how I've always tried to do this. So I apologize to both of you, you to your face and Mike to your ears. I'm always trying to find the other thing. I can't help myself.
It's in your nature.
It is in my nature. And so if I'm the scorpion giving the frog the ride across the river, I'm going to sting him. That's just what I'm going to do. So, because to me, what I find fascinating about the Frey family, in this futuristic world where everything seems to suck and the lurkers are the vampires, and it's they're trying to, like, the idea of family seems to not exist as much there. Like, you don't really see it. I mean, Lou, the little girl, of course, is there, but her, you know, she's kind of left alone. So it's like it almost feels like it's in the future, but it's also almost like a feudal state. And back then, you know, kids were just like running around and parents didn't care and they were just trying to survive. And we don't really see what happens to the Frey's parents.
We don't know. There's not any mention at all, is there, in fact?
No. And so that's another interesting look at how family works and the importance or not important. So it's just like me looking at things and trying to say, is there a comment there? And because this was coming out 2001, 2002, so Buffy is still going. So it's hard to not think about, well, what is he doing? How is the, and we know the scythe later, but what is the commentary on there? If you're reading this as a companion piece to the show, and so this is the part, Joyce has died now, Dawn is there, and we're really trying to get that sense of new family. You know, Willow and Tara have moved into the house. And so I just, that's again, me projecting, but I always kind of feel like that's what that is.
No, no, I think that's definitely true, but there's also the kind of, there's the community vibe as well, isn't there? Which we have in Buffy, and we have an angel of like people finding each other and coming together, and they have to, you know, you've got the Ketty Rules character in this, who is kind of a villainous, but steps up when he needs to. And like you say, with Lou, her parents kind of let her go around, and Melica is kind of a surrogate sister, a surrogate family member, but the community seems to rally around it, because when that terrible thing happens, we're spawning it towards, you know, we'll when Lou is killed, it affects everyone in their local community, doesn't it? It's also interesting, I think, that this is going on at the same, because we've got Buffy on air, we've got Angel on air, and depending on when the issue comes out, because this took a couple of years, didn't it, to finish?
Yeah.
We've got Firefly on air as well.
Yeah, and Dollhouse? No.
Yeah, no.
Was that 2003?
That was after, I think.
That starts after, okay, yeah.
That's post-Buffy, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, right. So crazy. Yeah, he's a busy guy at this stage. And plus, he was doing other movies and stuff, too. So, you know, always a script doctor as well.
Yes,
I think probably the other shows benefit sometimes to him being, as we discussed in Angel season one, sometimes the shows benefit from him being gone. So, you know, and this was good. I think this is an excellent story. You know, and I think it's a cool part of the verse, as it were. So let's talk, speaking of the verse, as you mentioned, Firefly, the language of Firefly is here. So there, again, we don't get a specific date. There's not like star date, blah, blah, blah.
No, it's like a couple of hundred years, isn't it? Since the last layer.
But so this is still Earth that was.
It seems so, yeah. Because they call it New York, don't they? In the, not in the book, but in the blurb on the back.
Yeah.
It's described as being set in Manhattan.
Right. So, but they're using language from Firefly. So what did you make of that?
Well, obviously, it's the first time I picked up on it on this read, actually, because I guess I don't know why. I would have watched Firefly probably before I read this. But I mean, yeah, are we meant to assume that's in the same verse as well?
Well, that's the question. So this is the big surprise question I had. I saw on Twitter the other day when somebody said, "Name your third favorite Whedonverse character," and someone put their third favorite character was Rivers, saying that not the singer of Weezer, but River Tam, because that person said, let's all face it, River is the future Slayer. So I was like, well, and as I'm reading Frey when that came out, I'm like, wait, are you at my house? Who is this? So what do you make to that? And this was that. So thinking about that person, Rando on Twitter, sorry, I didn't write down your name, Rando on Twitter, but good thought. And so that in conjunction with the language here, do you think that's true? Do you think that River is the future? Because she's human.
She is. I don't know if River specifically is. I think we might have seen something. Had Firefly kept going, I think we would have seen something. Whether it be River or maybe Kaylee would have suddenly, like, you know. Because as we see it, well, Kaylee's too old, I suppose.
Kaylee's too old.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think... I don't know if we're working too hard. I think we've done if we want to make it fit. I think it's probably just that he liked that word rutting, because it's only rutting, isn't it? There's none of the other, no Gram, there's no shiny, we have toy instead, don't we? And we have other language. So I just wonder if he's writing Firefly at the same time as this.
And so it just slipped in.
I like the idea, but I don't know if we're trying to force it.
It's possible. I'm rereading. So Emily St. John Mandel is this amazing novelist, and I am in lesbians with her writing. She wrote Station 11, which was the first book of hers I read, but it was her fourth book. And then I read The Glass Hotel, and now I'm going back and rereading her first three because her new one's coming out and I'm jonesing for it. So I'm just like, I haven't read these first three. What I'm discovering is it's all in the same world. Like characters and places from the other books are in it. So I'm reading a book that she wrote in 2009. And one of the characters is assigned to cover a story that happens at the beginning of Glass Hotel. And I'm like, son of a bitch.
Nice.
And it's like Stephen King does it. We already talked about him. Obviously Tarantino does it. So the connected verse, as it were, is a pretty cool idea.
Yeah.
And we all call it, is the Whedon verse is what everybody calls it. And obviously Buffy and Angel are the same verse. And Frey is too. So it's just, we are probably trying to force it, but I just think it's a, if it's your sandbox, why not play in it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the exact same thought went through my head. As soon as I saw that word rutting, I was like, oh, hang on, what's going on? Yeah. but there's really no other interconnecting tissue, is there, at all, I don't think.
Right. Except for the idea that River could be a future Slayer.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think there was anything in the show, and nor has there been in the comics since that has ever hinted that. She's never had any of the Slayer dreams or there's never been, so.
She'd be more related to Drew than anything.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Right, because she's a seer, too. So, but that's a different story for a different... I was just curious, so I was just like, wait for that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
We need to get somebody who knows on to ask them officially.
Yeah, yeah. Marty Noxon, are you out there, Marty? Coming in, Marty. We need an answer. What do you know? So anyway, or, you know, maybe we'll just reach out to some of the actors. I follow them on Twitter. I'm sure they want to talk to me.
I'm sure, yeah.
I'm sure that they have nothing better to do. So what do you think of let's talk about Urkon, the demon watcher, sort of awful monster guy. He looks like Hellboy. So her watcher is a little Hellboy, which again, this is on Dark Horse, so they could be like, hey, we can make this guy look, it's all right, we know the guy, where everything will be fine. So Urkon is her sort of watcher, sort of protector, sort of whatever. And then he does a heel turn, sort of. Mm-hmm. Well, totally, as he's the one who kills Lou. So what did you think of that as a story device? Why do that? Why not just have a good guy be a good guy?
I think it was it sets it apart, doesn't it? And shows you, it gives you that sense of the world that she's in. Compared to what Buffy's in, I think that's not something that would have appeared in the Buffy show. And actually, I don't, you know, it's been a while since I've read the comics, but nobody that close. I know Angel, but I mean, but nobody that close in terms of like human or in terms of that, like that protector or watchful.
Clem wasn't going to start killing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's held back, and it's really clever how they reveal it in issue 8, right at the very end. Sitting kind of the last bit of action that happens, isn't it, after the action. And I think he's a really interesting character. And I think design, Mike Mignola designs aside, I think it also reminded me of which makes sense because Del Toro reminded me of Pan's Labyrinth a little bit.
Sure.
As well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Pan in that. But he looks like a demon. He looks like the devil. So, I mean, we should have known it was coming all along, shouldn't we?
Right. Well, that's is it. So is that well, because it's like that subversive thing that you get is that, you know, you're set up to think, and I you know, rereading it, I can't remember the first time I read it, but I don't feel like the big reveal that Hearth is her twin brother is the big bad. I don't think that was that big of a shock to me, but I'd imagine like if I were 15 reading it, my mind would have leaked out my ears. But I feel like me reading it as a 20 something year old adult man, I was like, yeah, I get it. I get you don't see him die, so you know he's alive somewhere, right? She falls off the building.
And it's the most logical person for story purposes.
But it is a subversive twist, because you learn to love him. And again, I do think, like, you're right, the Pan's Labyrinth model, or to me, the Hellboy thing, because Hellboy is so awesome. Like, you want to give him a cuddle. So I feel like you're set up to be like, oh, Urkon, he's awesome. He's here to help her. And you see him save her a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And so he totally gets you on his side, only to discover. So what he does, people, if you've not read this, what is wrong with you? Because we are spoiling the show, I think. So Lou, the little girl who, like you said, is like is like the neighborhood mascot. She's missing an arm. And she's lovely and she's fun and she's adorable and you just want to give her a hug. But he kills her. He essentially on screen, he fridges her to give Mel the motivation to go do the things.
Yeah.
So it's like fridging in real time. And it's an interesting, again, this is me. It's a commentary on fridging.
Do you think? Interesting.
You're showing us why you do it.
Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, okay, yeah.
You're showing us not like fridging is bad. This mm-hmm. is, I don't think Joss would ever think fridging is bad. I don't think he thinks because he killed Tara. So come on, he's already yeah. done this, right? But maybe this was his test, right? When 2001, I guess Tara dies around this time-ish by the time mm-hmm. this comes out. So he doesn't mind doing it. But I also think it's like him saying, maybe justifying why he has to kill Tara, because sometimes you need a motivation. He's justified Urkon as the killer, but Whedon is the writer, is justifying why you have to do this sometimes. Greater good for greater numbers. If Mel doesn't get her ass together, they're all dead. So yeah. he says one little 8-year-old mutated girl, as opposed to the entire city of New York. Mm-hmm. He does a calculated risk. It's like it's like freshman philosophy class a little bit. Like,
yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, what are your gut reaction to it? And what do you think we as readers are supposed to take from it? Are we supposed to be on his side? Were you ever on his side? Or you're kind of like, well.
No, I don't think so. I think we're heavily on Melica's side, aren't we? I don't think there's ever the question. I think maybe afterwards you can take pause and think about it. But in the moment, you're totally with her and her reaction to finding Lou being dead. And then when the reveal that it's Urkon, and then what she does in response to that, which is obviously get him into the water tank and then kill him pretty easily, actually.
Yeah, because he doesn't like water. That's set up the whole time. Yeah.
Again, but which I don't think you necessarily get. I think it's very cleverly like drip-fed, no pun intended.
Yeah.
No, I think you're meant to be totally on Frey's side, don't you?
Yeah, well, I do. But I think that, like, right, but now, in the moment, you're like, yeah, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
But she doesn't give him a pass. And again, this is like in Buffy. Buffy kills Angel at the end of season 2. But then, you know, she brings it back and she gives him a pass. Like when he comes back, mm-hmm. she keeps it a secret and she gives him a pass. And Buffy and Angel is full of giving people's pass. In season 1, Angel gives Faith a huge pass. Faith is awful. Yeah. And so, again, he's setting us up, because by now you know it's in the Slayerverse. So he's setting us up for the hero of our series. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, to give somebody who did her wrong a pass, but he doesn't do that here.
No. I think again it's the world that this is in though, isn't it? I think this is a dystopian future, isn't it? So I think the world that Frey lives in doesn't allow for that.
It doesn't allow, because if she gives him a pass, then she's weak.
Yeah, I think so. What I'm about to say isn't a criticism. This isn't a grey world, really. There's not much grey here. There's kind of, you know, this is the right thing to do, because if you don't do this, as you said, like Manhattan and perhaps the world will be gone. And I know we do get those scenarios in the Buffy and Angel shows as well, but I think this is a story of absolutes, really, isn't it? And it's characters reacting emotionally, and it's characters acting without thinking, I think. Brilliant English. Acting without, you know, on instinct.
Yeah.
Rather than taking the time to think about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, the closest comparison I could come to is when Giles kills Ben.
Yeah.
That's the closest thing. And he does it because he knows Buffy can't. He's protecting mm-hmm. Buffy. And it's not like Ripper hasn't killed anybody before. I mean, like, we already know. Still, we're waiting for that young Ripper series. There's a young, handsome man with glasses in England who is very book smart and erudite. I'm looking at him right now. Maybe you could play the young Ripper.
I'm probably as old as Anthony Stewart Head was when he started in Buffy at this point.
Right, but yeah, well, you think so?
I don't know. How old is he in season 1 of Buffy? Probably.
Oh, maybe. Maybe I'm just old too. So, but anyway, I'm just saying, young Ripper, we need that. But yeah, I that's the closest thing I could come to. And it's hard, you know, obviously this has to be its own thing, but I couldn't help thinking of that, is that because he's not her actual watcher, and we got to talk about what happens to the watchers here in a second, but he's her he's her surrogate watcher. Mm. And so he does a thing that a watcher needs to do, which is motivate his slayer.
Mm.
And so, you know, Giles leaves in season 6. Giles makes her go through the test in season 4.
Season three.
So you do the things that you're supposed to do as the watcher. And so mm-hmm. for him, he's like, he's willing to take an 8-year-old's life if it means saving. So it's to me, it shows the weight of what watchers have to go through, like real watchers, because
that's interesting.
That, you know, it's like, I couldn't be a watcher because I couldn't do it. but this is what the Watcher has to do. That's the whole thing, is that the Watcher does the hard thing because it's not about the Slayer. The Slayer is a vessel. Mm-hmm. It's about saving humanity. Mm-hmm. And so that I just, you know, everything they do is pretty bad. The Watchers are terrible.
Yeah, it's true. They are. Yeah, yeah.
Historically, right? I mean,
yeah, we don't feel bad when they go, do we, in Buffy season 7?
No, not really. You know, luckily there's a rogue demon hunter out there still.
Luckily.
You know, so we're okay. There's two Watchers remaining. But yeah. And so let's talk about that, because we see at the end of Buffy season 7, which hasn't happened yet in this universe, like it's happened, but it hasn't happened. Most of the Watcher Council gets destroyed, but obviously they live on. And so what do you make to this version of the Watcher Council?
Yeah, so they've kind of gone crazy, haven't they, over time? Because there's not been a Slayer for at least a couple of hundred years, they say. I mean, there's a couple of panels, isn't there? And the idea is that Buffy was the last Slayer, and some we don't know how, but she ended all of demons on Earth, and then she disappeared. But there's no knowledge of what, and we never get to that point in the Buffy comics, do we?
Nope.
Yeah, and so from that point, they've kind of turned into those crazy people we see on the street with signs. The world is coming to an end. They turn into Rorschach, basically, don't they?
They do. Well, and that's the thing about Rorschach, right? I'm not a Rorschach right guy. Rorschach is wrong. But like, what you have to remember about Rorschach is he believes in something wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. He is a zealot, and these Watchers become zealots.
Agreed.
So what, not to make us, I know this isn't a show where I'm talking to Mike, but you and I have never really gone down the full religion conversation.
Let's do it.
But what do you say about that? Like, the Watchers are, it's a faith. They're not Christians. They're not pagans. They're Watchers. They believe in the religion they've created. We see in Buffy and in this that the Watchers create their own religion, and it is Watcherism, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so when a religion dies, if there's people who hang on to a religion, you're crazy. Like, if right now, if you walked out on the street tomorrow and someone was telling you that he was praying to Odin, you'd be like, aw. Yeah. But a few thousand years ago, people prayed to Odin because Odin was a god. Odin was their god. Yeah. You know, so what do you make about that commentary on the Watcher Council and what Watchers are? And because they're now all crazy people about like how faith works. Am I giving Joss too much credit for being deep here again? Or do you think there is a commentary on how religions die and that really religion is just zealotry? Some cases it's more organized than others.
I think that's probably there, but I think it's something, you know, you as a reader have found rather than something he intended. And that's the beat of art, isn't it? Is that it's not just what the author intends. It's what we can all see in it. I think he probably knew that he was going to be getting rid of the Watchers Council. I mean, from season 3, we've been invited to dislike the Watchers Council. I think he probably had his through line, and I think he wanted to show how far they'd fallen, and he wanted to just continue that idea of, you know, the Slayer doesn't need white men controlling her fate. I'm not sure there's a heavy commentary on religion intended, but it's interesting that there's one that you've got from it.
Yeah, because I always find belief is tricky. You know, you like something because you do, or you have faith in something because you do. Mm-hmm. And so I'll use so when I was a kid, this is when I was in high school, my cousin and my sisters and a couple of other friends, my sister wasn't always around, but when she was around, we did a thing, we called it sports talk. And the rule is we could talk about whatever we wanted, but you couldn't specifically talk about sports, politics, or religion, even though we called it sports talk, because the idea that those were the three things that people get the most mad about.
Sure.
So you could talk about political issues, but you couldn't talk about it this Democrat said or this Republican said. You could talk about religion, but you couldn't be like those stupid asshole Catholics or those stupid asshole Lutherans or screw the Jews or, you know, screw the Muslims. You couldn't be that. It had to be like, well, this is an interesting thing I saw this week about, you know, what's happening. What do you make of Israel? you know, in the way that, that, you know, should we have a two-party solution? So you're talking about religion and politics there. You're not thinking about it from, you're trying to be logical. So it's like, this would be like a fun Saturday night for me. And I'm not even making this up.
This is like on Vulcan or something, right?
No, nope, this is in my parents' basement. This is totally a factual thing that we did. Or it's somebody's basement. It was, and I was straight edge. They were all drinkers and doing drugs then. But we, I don't know why. I don't know how it started, but it was just a thing that we did. So, but the reason I bring all that up is because those are the three things for which people have the most faith. Like religion, sports, and politics all have the same thing, zealotry. You know, it, there's political parties that no longer exist. Like if I were tomorrow to be like, I want to register as a Whig, which was a party in my country years ago, WHIG, people would be like, nope. You can't, because it's not a thing anymore. You can't be like, I'm a Whig, and people like, no, you're not. But you could be. And if there's still one Whig out there, that person's considered a zealot and considered crazy. So, and it's the same with sports teams, and it's the same thing with that, with whatever. It's like so crazy to me that your favorite player is on your team and you love him or her, and then that person goes to play for a different team, like the team you hate the most, and now you hate that person. But wait, he was your favorite player last week. Like now Ronaldo's back and all the Man U fans are he's the you know, Saint Ronaldo, and I have issues with him as a human, regardless of as a football player. He's amazing. I'm not even going to pretend that he's not, but he seems like an awful person.
Sure. So,
but people love him, and they there's that weird zealotry thing there. So, so to me, I can't get past that. And you see it, I think, on display here. And I think Erin, the older sister, we haven't talked about her, her zealotry. And I find this interesting connection between the way the Watchers are so desperate. They're like hanging on to something we have to have. We believe and we believe. She believes in the law like so much that it's a detriment. And so Erin and Kate from Angel, we see an equal connection there too, because Kate in Angel has a belief. She believes in the law so much that it drives her crazy. So that was a long way to go to talk about faith and belief. And I get what you're saying. It's not necessarily there, but I guess, is it in everything? Is it just one of those topics that we can't pretend isn't there? If it's not there, then you deliberately didn't have it there.
No. No, no. I mean, I think, you know, he writes a character who lights himself on fire because they believe so much. So, I mean, I think, you know, there's definitely commentary there. But I think, you know, you're a very intelligent person, and you always come at things from wanting to find the deepest thing in it. And, you know, that's a compliment. That's something that's great about your character. I think sometimes you're reading or watching things by shallower people. doesn't mean you can't find it. That's not a problem.
That's fair.
But yeah, I mean, this character does light himself on fire. So he is certainly a zealot. I think that is the correct word.
Yeah. Is Erin a zealot?
Well, not by the end, no. But perhaps
Of course not by the end. Right, but at the beginning.
She needs to be helped, doesn't she, and changed. It's true. But I mean, could we argue Melica's a bit of a zealot too? In terms of like rejection of the norm.
Oh, like she's an iconoclast on purpose. Like she's not just an icon. She's just not somebody who's like me being a straight edge kid was just something I wanted. I wasn't like, I'm going to piss everybody off by not drinking and then they don't want to be my friends. Hooray. It was just, I didn't want to do it. I see what you're saying. As opposed to like, you're saying she's deliberately like, my sister's a cop, so I'm going to be the biggest dick I can be.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, I didn't see that. That's awesome.
She's kind of pushed herself to the fringe, isn't she? Because like, and she blames herself, doesn't she, for what happened to Hearth. So she has to keep punching herself over and over and over. And that is by living a difficult life and by putting herself in harm's way and by pissing her sister off. And
yeah. It's like she's whipping herself. Because she's working for a monster, literally. a mer person. She's always in. Yeah, that's right. She's like, essentially Erin is her mother figure. And so she's rebelling against her mother in the biggest way she can, which is to do.
You know, she's not rich because I don't know who is rich in this world. We don't really see that part of it, but she must be doing all right. And she lives in a one bedroom apartment. She's got no shower. She has to shower by propping herself up underneath a broken water pipe. And all of that feels like that's a world that she's making herself live in, I think.
Because Erin's got a house. Erin's place is okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. I just always think, you know, like I think being a police officer, I think you do it a lot of times because it's, you believe in it so much Mm-hmm. Or because it's a family thing. And either way, you're just, you're following something because you're a zealot, or you're following something because, like, the way most people are raised with faith, with religion, in my country anyway, I'm not, I don't want to speak to how it is there. But here, most people are whatever their parents are.
I think that's just, probably true here as well. Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, because I was raised Catholic and chose not to be, so we didn't raise our kids with anything. So a couple of them aren't anything. One of them dabbled, she dipped her toe into Christianity for a while, and then she read the whole Bible and was like, out. Have you read this shit? Have you read this book? I'm like, yeah. She's like, it's nuts, like, for sure. And the other one, our youngest is converting slowly into Judaism. That's just her choice. And that's cool, right? So because she got to make the decision all on her own, you know, we didn't, and it took her a long time to come to that. It wasn't until high school. She was kind of like, you know, she needed something. I understand the need for faith. I'm not trying to shit on it. I'm not saying let's all be atheists and blah, but I just think it's interesting how we choose to believe. And I think a lot of police officers, it's family. It's like, oh, my dad was a cop and my uncle was a cop, or my uncle was a fire. Like, there's families of firefighters. There's families of, and there's all kinds of families of musicians, families of the Manning brothers over here, American football players. They all play, you know, they all, it's a thing. So, and that's like a religion for them. Like, you know, the Mannings, American football is a religion to them. They live and die it and breathe it and dream about it. And other people do. So again, that's where the sports comes in. So I do, I just think it is really, I just think it's a really great look at the, you know, why we do what we do. And I think it gives the Slayer verse such depth. I think people who have not, I think probably most Buffy fans have read this, don't you think?
I would have thought so. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it really just fills it out. Do you like that in general, the idea of an expanded verse? Like, do you like Mike does his Star Wars show, obviously on the Scary Network. Do you like that? Do you want an expanded universe? Do you want to know what that third bounty hunter in Empire Strikes Back had for lunch last week?
Probably not, no, but I will inevitably read it. I don't think I wouldn't have asked for this Frey book, I don't think. And I wouldn't have asked for Buffy season 8, 9, 10. I can't remember how far it goes.
12.
Goes up to 12, okay, yeah. But this is so different yet within the world that it definitely is doing its own thing, isn't it? But has some recognisable traits. I think it's very clever in how, you know, it drives its story forward with the twins and the splitting of kind of the Slayer heritage and the Slayer. So Melika gets all the physical traits, doesn't she? She gets all the strength and the power and the dexterity, and whereas Hearth gets all the kind of I don't know how to put it. He gets like he has the dreams, doesn't he? But he gets all the visions and
the Slayer wisdom. Would you say?
I suppose, yeah, like the collected years of.
Ooh, do we want to go Jungian? Is that what we're about to do? He gets the collective unconscious goes into Hearth Frey.
Well, he does, doesn't he? Because he says, doesn't he? He says, like, you know, I can see the past and I know what's going to happen in the future, and it's because he's got that interconnectivity, isn't he?
Yeah.
I think it's not needed, but it does broaden the world out in a really interesting way.
For sure. I think it's really fascinating. I do love the idea of the twins. I think that's super cool. I think that's one of my favorite things about this is the idea of and they're fraternal twins, but there is still twins are twins, right? It doesn't we're watching the show on Hulu, but we read the book too. It's called Nine Perfect Strangers by Leanne Moriarty. And there's twins in there, and one of the twins kills himself. It's not a spoiler alert, that's the plot of one of the characters' storylines. But like it's been 3 years when we meet the character, her brother killed herself, and like what that's like for her. And how it's different than it is for her parents. And so like, I don't have a twin, but you know, the twins that I know, it is like, it is really hard. Like being away from your twin is hard. Even a fraternal twin. It's just like, even if you live far away, like you the need to touch that person all the time. Like when they're together, they touch, they have to sit near each other. So that it's gotta be really, really hard. So I think it adds an extra layer of pain for Mel. Losing a twin brother, and not only losing a twin, but blaming yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very cool.
It's very cool. And it just makes, it's such an interesting look at what it is to be a Slayer, isn't it? And also opens up their world, which I know the comics eventually do. The idea that, you know, slayers don't have to just be attractive young women. They can come in all shapes and sizes and all forms.
Took him a while to get there, though.
It did take him a while to get there, I agree. But this is perhaps the first time, isn't it? The first thing.
Yeah.
Yes, it did take him a while to get there. And, you know, that's something we can talk about in terms of the presentation of Frey as well, I'm sure, as
yes,
we go.
Yes, as we'll get into that in a second. But I have a couple more questions. One about Icarus and Frey, or Hearth. Mm. So Icarus is the sire, is Hearth's sire. He's just this, like, all-around kind of... He reminds me, again, very Frank Miller-y, but there's a lot of Frank Miller in this, so I'm just not even going to deny it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The mutants in Dark Knight.
Yeah.
He has that vibe, and the lurks in general kind of have that vibe. So in the story, this is so cool, and I just think, and honestly, I'd forgotten about it until this reread, because it's been a while since I've read this. Hearth turns himself, and it's because... Yeah. It's because he has the Slayer knowledge, because he knows what vampires are. He doesn't call them, like, at first, but then he's always known what they are. So when he's faced with imminent death, Hearth is drinking him. He bites Hearth's face and drinks from Hearth. Wow. So it's like, it's not like normally when you see it in Buffy, it's like they drink and then they cut their chest or something just to get a good cleavage shot. And then they drink from it, or they, and it's like, couldn't it just be your wrist? Does it have to be that? But it's always that. Very lots of breast suckling. But he doesn't, there's no breast suckling this. He bites his face and he drinks from him. And it's amazing. And Icarus is genuinely surprised. Like that could happen, because no one would do that. Why would you bite me? Why would you know how to? And that's how he realizes, oh, he's better than me. So what did you make to that? The way that Hearth turns, because Icarus is technically his sire, but not really. It's like he almost sired himself. And how do you think that plays into the fact that we know you, because like he knows, because he's got all the Slayer knowledge, he's going to give up his soul and a demon will take over his body, but he does it anyway. So what is that saying about Hearth, the need to live forever, the need to just live, the need to survive, like the survival instinct, thoughts in general? I just think it's such a cool scene that I totally forgot about. And I was like, holy shit, that's awesome.
No, I agree. It is really cool. I think the Icarus Hearth relationship gave me a bit of Master and Anointed One vibes. From early on. But I agree with everything you're saying about Icarus. I think he's a really cool design. I like the fact his tribal tattoo almost makes a kind of a swastika as well on his forehead.
For sure.
Maybe that's because I've just read Mouse again.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, but I saw it too. Yeah.
Okay, good. I wasn't the only one. But there's loads of interesting stuff. I think like there's the scene when, I'll get to Hearth in a minute, but just while these things are popping in my head.
No, go, like, yeah.
When Icarus gets the other lurk to bite his finger off, it's almost kind of like a Yakuza type. So there's all these nice, like kind of how lurks, as they're called, have like developed over the years. Because they must have been around the whole time. Like there's been no Slayer for 200 years, but I guess there's been vampires just hiding in the shadows. And we see at the end, there's a hell of a lot of them. Almost like, you know, the Turok Khan at the end of, is that what they're called? The Turok Khan at the end of season 7 of Buffy.
Yeah, yeah.
With that big reveal of like, you know, thousands of them. Yeah, I think because you have the back and forth, don't you? Like Icarus, you used to be the big badass of the crew. And now, as it's revealed to us, there's this little kid who's bossing you around. But as you said, like he is a pure vampire, isn't he? I suppose. Whereas the lurks are almost kind of another stage down. And I know vampires are often disparaged as being like the worst kind of demon in the Buffyverse, or, you know, that with the weakest link to what used to be demons. But the lurks seem to be maybe another step down. And when Hearth is a vampire, he does the changing his face. He seems to become a bit more strong and powerful when he becomes a vampire, which we've seen in the verse before. And he seems to have his mental faculties about him a bit more than the others do as well. So I think it makes sense that he becomes instantly like the leader. And as you said, because he marks himself out as, I guess, as soon as he woke up, Icarus was surprised, as you said. You actually see the shot, don't you, on the rooftop of him like being like, why have you done that? But then I assume then he took half somewhere so he could wake up, and half probably immediately woke up and started explaining the lore and the history and who they are. And so he would make himself stand out as being above. He's a bit batty from Blade Runner in that way as well, I suppose.
Yeah.
The same but different.
Right. Yeah. And it's because your intelligence matters too, right?
Yeah.
The fact that Hearth is smart. And you're right. Mm-hmm. It's like Hearth, and then there's Icarus, which I like, too close to this. I mean, you know, come on, that's on the nose. That's not even subtext. It's just text, which is fine. Yeah. Text is also fine. But yeah, because Icarus, like you said, for whatever reason, has evolved differently in a more pure way. And it's almost as though it feels like some of the lurks are like drinking each other. And that's a very Blade, you know, back to Del Toro, Blade 2, is that Blade 2, where they start drinking each other? So there's some of that happening here. I mean, there's lots of influences in this of the other things that he's seen. He's like, I just saw, because this came out. He's like, I just saw Blade 2. Let's do that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Let's make them look like that. So yeah, no, I think it's... I think you're right. I think that this is also like, you know, Hearth is smarter than them. So therefore, while he's still a little kid, and I love that scene when you first see them together, he's still little. Is he 14? Is he even?
Or is he the ages aren't set, are they? Because they say, what is it? They say it's 6 years or something, don't they, since the incident.
Right. And so she's 19, according to the, but according to the back, the data. So, you know, he's 12, 13 years old. And so he's so much smaller than her, which I think is really funny, but he's such a badass because he's smart. And there's something to that, you know, knowledge is power. And obviously that's the whole thing, is that these other watchers, they're not knowledgeable anymore, whereas Ukron is. And so therefore he has power because he knows.
Definitely.
There's a lot of that there. And that's, of course, obviously a thing throughout the verse. The more you know, I mean, the reason that Wesley is Wesley and the reason that Lorne is Lorne and Angel is because they know things. Mm-hmm, and it gives them power over other people, because, you know, you need that person who can give you the answer. And, you know, it's how the internet changed things. And the internet doesn't seem to be alive and well here.
No, it does not.
It's definitely a Blade Runner-y world, like you said.
Yeah, again, but because there are those mentions, aren't there? Like Malika says about, like, you know, down here where we live in that kind of Blade Runner way, like up there things are different, but down here where we are, I can't remember what the area is called. It's almost kind of like the Narrows in Batman.
Yeah,
or
that's what I thought of it as. Yeah,
it's got that kind of feel, hasn't it? There's another world going on somewhere else that we don't get to see,
which is okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That story that isn't related to this. It's probably not as interesting.
Right. And I think that's where Firefly shines too, right? Because you see both. You see the Tam's world. So they do. Occasionally you just visit the other worlds. You acknowledge it exists. And that's that one line. That's good writing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, we acknowledge the whole world isn't like this. This is a lower class issue. And up until this point too, you know, our slayers, I mean, Buffy's the you know, Buffy's a middle class kid, you know what I mean? Her mom runs an art gallery. It's not like, you know, they're not starving in any stretch of the imagination. So it's interesting. What would a street rat with the Slayer powers be? Oh, she'd be a thief. Yeah. She'd be the best thief there is. Yeah. So I think that's really smart, because there is always like that idea that with great power comes great responsibility, but sometimes with great power comes feeding yourself.
And so go on. Yeah, yeah.
No, that's, you go.
Because yeah, there's a line later on in the comic, and it seems to be leaning in. And I wonder at what point, whether this is something that's going on in Joss's mind, because they use the word faith at a certain point in this comic. And of course, you can't say that in a Slayer verse without thinking of the character faith. And it doesn't mean faith as we've discussed before about zealotry and belief. It's like, it's more to like have faith in yourself, or faith, you know, in what you can do and your abilities. And obviously, Faith is a much closer character to Frey than Buffy is.
100%. Yeah.
So I just wonder where the thought process is there. And we've discussed before, like, was there any idea of making Faith into her own TV show? Or it feels like he's being more drawn in that way. Like, that's a more interesting story for him to tell. And let's be honest. I mean, and probably if we had a Faith show, and we, instead of Buffy, if it had been called Faith of Vampire Slayer, that would have had a lot of social commentary in it.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist in Buffy. It would have been.
Right. It would have been. He would have had to set it in Cleveland, where the other Hellmouth is, because she's from Boston. It would have had to have been set in Cleveland, not in Sunnydale.
Yeah, and it would have been much more like Frey.
100%.
Rather than, you know, white happy Californians, it would have been. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
a myriad of different characters living a really tough life.
Yeah, and I've always heard that the reboot that they considered, the TV show reboot, was not really going to be, like, it's going to be called Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but it's just the new Slayer's name is Buffy. She's in this, right. It's in verse. So it's just the new Slayer. It takes place
after. A bit like the Boom comics. It's, well, that's, I know it's a different dimension, but it's that's not a different meant dimension. It's the same
it's,
character.
It's been discovered. It's the dimension where they don't have shrimp.
Okay, good.
It was revealed finally. Who was it who says it? Anya says, no, Tara says, what's shrimp?
Right.
Nice. So, yeah. Yeah, because the
still
original...
Still got bunnies, though. Poor Anya.
Yeah, I know. So our Buffy ended up in that universe. And so during that whole crossover, everything, you discover Anya is the key to it all. And she explains something. And then they cut back to... I'm pretty sure it was Anya says it. She's like, what's shrimp? And you're like, ace. That's amazing. That's amazing. And I'm probably wrong. It probably wasn't Anya. Neil will tell us, because Neil's been reading those too when we talked to him. Okay. I'd be like, you are wrong. It was not Anya, it was Willow who said it or something. But anyway, it was pretty funny. It's like, oh, but yeah, that's a different dimension. I think what they're doing, it is supposed to be this dimension taking place after season 12. And there's just going to be a new Slayer and her who's named Buffy after, like probably after Buffy.
I'm sorry, that is stupid.
You will watch but it. If
it
they
doesn't
make
matter.
It,
like,
watch it.
It can literally be called anything. That they can be called, you know, like, Table, the vampire, it doesn't matter. The vampire show is the bit that is going to get people in. They don't need to be called Buffy. That is mental.
That's it's not officially happened. And now with everything that's happened with him, it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, fair. Do you mean like, but I mean, it literally could be anything. It could be Tony the Vampire Slayer.
Right, it doesn't.
Fun.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to watch that because I know it's set in the world. And yeah. I'd much rather that than it be called another person. That's, yeah, I'm not.
That's what I heard. That's what, and you know, the internet's never wrong, Jack.
No, it's true. Say what they need. They need, looking at the back of this comic, and
they
the
need to make a Frey show. Yeah.
Yeah. The inspiration for Frey. It should be called Matilda the Vampire Slayer and have it as the character from Leon, and that's have a proper crossover. That'd be amazing.
Oh my God. If Matilda grew up to be a Slayer.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That gave me.
I am Jack's Musings. This is my Gmail and Twitter. If anyone wants to come at me and tell me that I can write that. Great.
Write the shit out of that. I mean, you know how IDW loves to do some crap. Of course, they don't own Buffy anymore. So
sad.
Oh my God. But I just think the idea of her killing vampires. I mean, that would be the natural progression of her character.
Agreed. Yeah. She's the best assassin in the world. What's next?
Oh my God. And Natalie Portman, that's how you knew that was the most talented person in the room, right? You're like, you're 8.
Yeah.
What is happening? How are you this good? I wasn't at 8.
Scary.
I wasn't good at anything. What are you doing? No. I don't. Maybe she was 10 in that, but regardless, what a performance!
Yeah,
what a performance! Gary Oldman's finest performance, in my opinion, is that film.
It's probably up there. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God. Anyway, we're not talking about this, but that is a great idea. Digress. We're sold. All right, well, we do need to talk about the art as we come towards the end. So it is drawn by Carl Moline. We're saying it is inked by Andy Owens, and then it is colored by maybe one of the best, probably the best working colors, although I do love Jordi Belair, who actually did go on to write the Buffy thing. She has nothing to do with this, but it just always, like, she and Dave Stewart, I think, are the best colorists working right now. Dave Stewart, damn.
Oh, the colors in this are amazing. I mean, just even the consistency of Frey's hair, I don't know.
Unreal, right?
Does it? Yeah.
Oh, he's so good. But anyway, what do you make to Carl and Andy's design? Carl is listed as co-creator, but he's just the penciler. Yeah. So I've seen the process of how that works. And so you have to give Andy Owens a lot of credit. He definitely gives Dave Stewart a lot to work with. I think it would be fascinating to see what Stewart could have done without the inks, with just the pencils. But the inks give us some really good texture and dimension. And then Stewart fills in the rest. So what do you think of the look? You said we couldn't get away with, because you're right, Frey does look, or Malaka does look a lot like Faith. What do you think?
Faith come Natalie Portman, absolutely. Yeah. I think after reading, so I just read the, I read the graphic novel, and then I sort of avoided reading the foreword stuff because I thought, you know, oh God, it's going to be cringy reading that, based on everything that we've learned since. And it was a little bit cringy.
For sure.
But I think there's a definite attempt to give her a character. Even to the point of, like, you know, she's scarred from the fight with, I assume, from the fight with Icarus.
From early on, yeah, right.
From early on, from the flashback. So she's kind of got a scarred face. But, I mean, she's got a cool look. She's got that kind of cool future look. But she's not necessarily drawn to be beautiful, I don't think. I think she's drawn to be a character.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So she's not Buffy. There's a bit more to her. And I think that's good. And I think it's clear they're trying to do that. But then I think they do slip into the unnatural poses, the, you know, there's a, you know, like a butt crack shot, and there's a little bit of that starts creeping in. And I hadn't noticed it before. And I think, you know, you've woken me up a little bit to that from the time that we spent talking together. And I recommended to you to read Neozoic. And it was one of your criticisms of that comic was like, you liked the characters and it was a cool world, but it was a little bit too midriffy.
For no reason.
And it's the same here, right? Yeah, Freya's never got her midriff covered up, I don't think.
Never once. That's silly. Mm. And it'd be different. And again, I understand if everybody is, you know, got the right to bear arms and everybody else is just wearing, and at least with Frey, she's wearing a tank top. Whereas in Neozoic, it's like full sleeves and a midriff. I'm like, wait, and what now? But yeah, no, it is definitely, you know what it reminds me of? And again, because he wrote Alien 4, which I like more than, I like Alien 4 more than I like Alien 3, but.
Sure. Okay. Fair.
I read this and I couldn't get out of like his version of Ripley is Frey too.
Right.
Okay, and that when you think about Ripley, like Sigourney Weaver is a queen, right?
Of course,
but I don't find her, she's not, you know, she's not, I'm going to say Donna Reed because Donna Reed was like my first celebrity crush and everybody, please feel free to make fun of me, but she's not conventionally beautiful in any way.
Sure.
Sigourney Weaver, but she's amazing. She's one of the best actors ever. She can do action. She can do comedy. She's awesome. I really am a huge fan, but she's not conventionally beautiful. And so that's, but when by the time you get to that fourth one, you know, and she's not even human, but they do sex her up a little in that one. She's wearing like a cat suit and everything. And then you're like written by Joss Whedon. You're like, gotcha. See what you did here. So I feel like that's what it is. It's like, you're trying to show like, female empowerment, but also cat suit, but also midriff, but also whatever. So that was my vibe. I don't know if you felt that way. And of course, I could be just because I know he wrote them both, but that was my feel.
No, I think it's fair. And I think, we have to acknowledge these things. I think it's a shame because I would just want to sit here and celebrate that art, really. I think the art is absolutely amazing. I think the inks are important because I think this is a noir world, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it gives us that light and dark, that shadow. It gives us a chiaroscuro. It gives us the, you know, the harsh difference. And then we've got the beautiful colours, which brings everything to life. And Malin's artwork is amazing. Like, his characters feel real. Their face expressions
are always clear. Oh, his Urkhan is amazing. And you can tell, you're right. Like, it's a love letter, Mike Molina, or Mike Mignola. But it's also, he does move in a very specific way. And Malin gets a lot of movement out of his characters. And I like that. I like a book. If an artist can make me feel the movement of the thing, and with an action scene, it's easy. It's like feet and whatever. And you know, one of my favorite things Andy Kubert does with Nightwing is he leaves the track behind.
Nightwing, okay, nice.
Right? You know what I'm talking about? So it's like he jumps from building to building and you see where he was.
Yeah, this does that, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah, and I love that.
When Frey's tumbling, yeah.
Those are so he does that. He does that here. And I think, man, it's so cool. He really captures and the lurk. Like, their name is an onomatopoeia for what they do. I mean, it's so good.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I get it. I get you want your female action heroes to have just a bit of sexiness in them. I get what you're saying.
That's fine.
But it's like, there's a difference between being sexy and being exploitative.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's not all the way through. And I think most of the time, there's just a couple of shots.
The shower.
I
mean,
the shower is bad, yeah. And it's later on when Urkhan and Melika are investigating, I think, the sewers, and he's saying, I don't want to go in there. And there's just a shot from a weird angle. And you've literally got she's wearing like low slung trousers. And there's just that little hint. There's just a few moments that are just a little bit unnecessary, I think.
Yeah.
Go on. Yeah, yeah.
I was just going to say the same thing over and over. I heard myself, so I stopped. I'm like,
because Blade Runner 2049, you know, we've talked about Boner. That has moments where you could be critical of that, but it's characters who are essentially prostitutes. So they're dressed like that for a reason. Yeah. And it's I can't remember any of the names anymore. It's Ryan Gosling's AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, hologram girlfriend. So there's a reason for it here. It's objectifying her where I don't think we really need to.
Right, because you don't need to. I haven't watched it yet, I'm sure. Have you watched Kate yet? Mary Elizabeth Winstead's new movie? That looks amazing, right? And I'm sure people are going to watch it and be like, whew. Right? But from what I've seen in the trailers, she's, you know, it's Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who's an attractive lady being a badass, and that's sexy. And you're like, woo. But I'm sure it's not just going to be here I am in a tank top, or here I am in a steel bikini, you know, because that's dumb. She's an assassin. Yeah. She's out killing people. She can wear a shirt. And I think the idea that the only way to have a female character be sexy or to be attractive is to put her in a cat suit or whatever. I mean, in the original Alien, to go back to that, Ellen is in her underwear a lot. And at no point are you like, it's never that way.
No.
It's never shot in a lurky, creepy way. And I guess it's different directors, obviously. You know, I mean, that's not who Ridley Scott. He never does that. I mean, even in his new ones with Charlize Theron, you know, there's a few scenes in there where you're like, maybe you're trying to linger a little too long, but he cuts just fast enough. He's trying to show how strong she is, as opposed to being like, look, she's almost naked here. It's like, we can move past this. So I just think it just needed to be handled a little bit differently, because she's a badass. And she's also a cartoon character. She's fictional. You know what I mean? It's like, I get it. I get what it is. I mean, every superhero is all jacked up and you can see every muscle of their eight pack and they're all ready for the fight club. But it's just like, let's make. But it is beautiful to look at, though. God, it's such a beautifully drawn book.
It is. And it's a very minor criticism. And it's a case of, you know, maybe three or four panels across an eight issue. So we're probably making it a bigger deal than we need to. Because all the positive outweighs this very small negative.
100%. Yeah. Oh, 100%.
It's one of the, I mean, I would say it's probably one of my favorite ever, like in terms of the style of it. And clearly, Whedon liked it, because Buffy season 8 feels very Malene style. I can't remember who draws that, but those first issues of Buffy feel, that first run feels very similar in its art style as well and coloring.
I agree. I could not agree more. I think there's a lot of just really mad skill, and because in a world that's crazy like this, to bring some humanity is hard. And I think that's what Moline does. Is he definitely makes it. Is Carl Moline, season 8? Okay. I just looked. That's why it looks like him.
Cool. That's why it looks like him, because it's him.
Because it was him. Yep, he did the original ones. Him and Jorge Giantre, I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong, inker, believe it or not, Andy Owens.
Okay, well, that's why I love that issue on Buffy cover, then.
Because they did it. Yep. Yeah, but I think what makes good science fiction books work is when the characters, when there's some humanity to them. Mm-hmm, it's like, we can forgive a lot of things in superhero movies and science fiction movies. Like, we're like, hand wavy science, flux capacitor, it doesn't matter, whatever. We forgive all that stuff. But it's like, we still need a little bit of something to connect to, even if it's a movie about monsters. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, even if it's like, there's no humans in the story, you still need it. Like, you're rewatching Toy Story with your son, the Toy Story series. And it's like, you know, I mean, they're humanoid figures, but a lot of people's favorite character is, you know, the pig.
Yeah, I mean, Rex is amazing.
Mr. Potato Head. You know, it's like these are characters people love, and they're not people, but it's because they're expressive and they have a human element to them. So like, you can get over a talking dog or the dinosaur or whatever, the slinky dog, because it doesn't matter, because it's drawn in a very expressive way, and they have great personalities. Yeah. So, and I think her personality, I think there's a lot of showing, not telling, which I'm sure was hard for Joss, because boy, does he like to tell.
He does. There's hardly any of that in this at all. Exposition wise, it's really light.
And that's impressive.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think I haven't read it for a while, but I really, I know we don't want to be too celebratory of him based on everything that's come out, but I really enjoyed his Astonishing X-Men run as well. Yeah.
Oh, lots of people do. Sure. It was good.
I need to go back and reread it.
Yeah.
But it feels like that this era, perhaps, you know, we've got Firefly in this era as well. He's at his peak, isn't he? You know, you and I are both on record saying Buffy is our favorite show ever, and that's never going to change.
Never.
I can't see anything will ever come out that will ever replace that, because of what it means to me and means to you and my sister. And
No, it's totally
true. It's not his peak writing. I think, you know, Frey, Firefly.
Right, because we agree Firefly's a better, and we don't know because it's so small. But I mean, pound for pound, you got 12 perfect, almost near perfectly written, scripted, acted shows.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of showing, not telling in there. He trusted, he got a really good cast too. I mean, you know, your big three actors in that. And then, you know, plus you throw Adam Baldwin in. I mean, it's a really good, and his own, his personal life shit notwithstanding, he's still a really good actor, right?
Adam
Baldwin's in something, you're like, boy, he's probably good.
Yeah.
Not one of the other Baldwin brothers, which has probably been a bane of his existence, having that last name.
I bet it has, yeah.
Because he's of age with the rest of the Baldwins. He's like, yeah, God damn it. I mean, that's his choice. He could have changed his last name. What's the line in Office Space? Why should they change my name? He's the one who sucks. So, and not that, you know, I think Alec Baldwin's a fine actor. I just think he's also a douche. So there's lots of douchiness. That's the problem, right? We had this conversation with Spider-Dan. It's like, what do you do? What do you do with the art when it, and it's this, it's the level of, and because we've not heard the worst of the worst things with Joss. We know he's a dick. We know he's a screamer. We know he thinks, obviously, he's probably a bit of a racist. He's definitely a sexist, definitely a homophobe. And yet he's written some amazing characters. And so it's like, because he doesn't act like he has these bad ideas. Like Frank Miller has terrible ideas too, but isn't born again perfect.
True.
You know? It is, yeah. So it is. I mean, is it the best thing he's done? Is it better than Year One? Is it better than Dark Knight Returns? Probably. I mean, and he's a giant dick, right? Yeah. He's an awful human being, but so it's like you have to, because he's not physically harmed anybody. He says awful words, but it's like, but most artists, most people have said something terrible. I know I have. I can't, I don't want to. And again, it's different being judged on when you're 15 or when you're 55. Maybe you should learn a little something, but yeah, I'm not trying to celebrate him, but it's also just hard to say, you know, I don't want to pretend this art doesn't exist and that this art isn't good.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, yeah, we have to say that. And I think what's interesting rereading this now and where what he had done before, what he was doing at the time and what he's gone to do since. And I know, like, we've just had The Nevers, which I think moving into what I think now calling season two will be a very different show. But having just had that come out as well, there really is the Joss Whedon template, isn't there? There really is the Joss Whedon trope. Like end of issue 7 here, a big giant dragon dinosaur thing appears.
Yeah.
It's very Avengers Assemble.
It is totally.
And the final battle is very not fade away from the end of Angel season 5. And as you know, it's very Frank Miller, it's very Mike Mignola, it's very, but within his kind of body of work, I think he has things he keeps coming back to, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think because it works. And when you watch S.H.I.E.L.D., like I loved the first few seasons of S.H.I.E.L.D., and he was involved with those, he and his brother. And it was very much like, here's old snarky wise guy. Here's badass. He had Ming-Na Wen was in that. She was amazing, of course. You've got brainy people over here. You've got new kid who's probably all powerful, who's the chosen one. This person's a little magic. This, you know, so it's like, you're like, oh, click, click, click. Here's the thing. Here's how it's going to work. These two, there'll be no sexual chemistry because there's not supposed to be. These two, that's all it'll be because it's supposed to be. And you just could... You knew what it was, but it was still watchable.
Sure. I mean, I dropped out after one season, but
we dropped it after 3-4. We loved Fitzsimmons. We loved the two of them.
Yeah.
And those two actors are great. And of course, I like Ming-Na Wen. She's always good. I think she was great in that show. And I think more badassery from her. But again, it definitely followed his script. It's so funny because I was like,
I think it's really like. It's that thing you come to later on, isn't it? Like, I don't think, again, when I first read Frey, I don't think I would have, well, we hadn't had Avengers at that point, so I wouldn't have known. But there's a definite kind of template that we're going back to. But to bring it full circle to what we were saying before, I think this does feel like an artistic peak, probably.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. I think it's probably his best comic. I mean, those Astonishing X-Men notwithstanding, he's also playing in somebody else's sandbox. It's him playing in someone else's sandbox. It's just playing in his own. And there's something to that. There's always something to people having an editor. As you know, I am Team Murkowski, but I also know somebody needed to tell them to know once in a while, and they wouldn't have been without not making movies for 10 years, right?
As I am Team Tarantino, and every now and then he needs to get told.
He does. Sometimes you need to be like, listen, you can't, Hateful Eight, that opening scene is too long.
Agreed.
nobody told him no. And it's like, oh my God. Okay. You're shooting on film. It's beautiful. It's snowing. This is awesome. Can you cut it down to 90 seconds instead of 8 minutes of that?
I mean, to be fair, it could have been a 90 minute movie, I think, but,
I agree. I totally agree. So yeah. So I think he probably, those X-Men run is so good is because somebody told him no. He's not going into Marvel and telling Joe Q what to
do. Yeah, sure.
I mean, that's the one time where you're not the biggest fish in this pond. Wasn't Quesada in charge of Marvel at that time? I don't think he's like...
Makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure he's not telling him... It's just like now at DC, you're going to go in and tell Jim Lee what to do? You are not.
Yeah.
You know, so that's not how that's going to go. When the boss is Jim Lee, you're like, you got a boss. What about this idea? You like it? Okay, cool. You know, like you, if you get too far, you've got an editor over the top of you.
Yeah.
And he needs that sometimes. So, well, I feel like we did it. I mean, 8 issues is really tight. But it's such a great story. And it's, again, as always, the beautiful thing about art, as you said, is the other things you talk about, the other things that art does. Art is good because it's not just that thing. My latest Pop Gorilla, I kind of lost my mind and I started swearing at random people. So I apologize if you've listened to that yet.
I haven't.
It's unearthed about the new Jessica Cruz comic. And it's like one of those YA ones. It's about a Mexican girl. And so, you know how people are. They're like going to shit on it just because the main character is a Mexican teenage girl and she's an illegal immigrant. So people are like, social justice warrior bullshit. So I kind of lost my mind in the middle of the Pop Gorilla review. It's because the art moved me. I thought it was beautiful and it was a great story. And, but I know people are going to hate it for the wrong reasons. Hate it for the right reasons. Hate it because you don't like the art style. Hate it because you think there's these gaps in logic. There's some of those, but you know, it's always like people hate just to hate. And I think the reason that this works is because it's art. It gave us something to talk about. It's we could start over and have a whole different conversation other than isn't Carmeline an amazing artist? I think we need that.
Yeah. That's going to come out every time.
Yeah, for sure. And when we do season 8 at some point in time, that will happen again.
It will, now that we both know he did that too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So the final thing is always, who's this for? Who do you recommend this to?
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think, if you're a Buffy fan and you haven't read this, you need to. If you're a dystopian sci-fi fan and you haven't read this, you're going to see some tropes, but you're going to see something new too. It crosses that divide, I think. Is it I'm trying to think about, my eldest is 9. I'm trying to think when I might give this to him. Soon, I reckon. Soon.
Yeah, I'd say 12.
Yeah.
Maybe not even 12. I mean,
maybe next year.
Yeah, I don't think it's super 10 dark.
Feels about right. I think he'd be really into this. I think he'd really enjoy it. And I think, we've spoken before. He likes a lot of things I like because inevitably he's had a dad who's exposed him to it, as we do.
Yeah.
But he's not massive into comic books yet. And I've bought him a few and I'm not forcing him down his throat. And he's used his own pocket money to buy some too as well. But they kind of get bored and he's excited. And then they go on a shelf and he forgets. This is one I think that might get him. This would capture him. I think he'd read this in one sitting.
Yeah, I did. My reread was in one sitting. It's like, I don't make any plans.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I agree. I think if you are a fan of course, Ripley, this is for you. If you like the Alien movie and you like her progression, because obviously who she is in movie 1 and movie 4 are quite different, rightfully so. But I think if you like that, if you are one of the people who are like, I need more badass, if you like Halo Jones, if you like, any kind of like fun female empowerment stuff. And if you don't, even if you just like a good story, it doesn't have to be just because it's a woman. It's a lead. Just think, I agree. I think you should hand this to some 12-year-old boys and be like, badass. Yeah, yeah. This is what badass.
That's a good shout. Actually, thinking about the arc that Frey goes through in 8 issues, she really does change.
Yeah.
That's a good shout. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a hero at the end. And so that's why it's disappointing that nothing else happened, because it was definitely set up for the few further adventures of Frey. So,
yeah.
Again, well, you're going to do it where it's going to be Matilda the Vampire Slayer. We already have agreed that's going to happen. I can't wait to read that. fan fiction, you can get away with anything.
It's true, yeah.
There's no copyrights in fan fiction for whatever reason. So feel free. I will read the shit out of that. we know some artists. Maybe we can make, we'll make things happen. So
nice.
Well, this has been fun. Thank you for joining me on this new thing. So should we tease what we're doing in a month from now?
Yeah, why not? Let's do it.
We're going to, and this will make our good friend Matthew B. Lloyd happy.
Yes, it will.
We're going
he inspired to, the choice, in fact.
He did. We are going to go back to IDW and no, Dynamite. It's Dynamite.
Dynamite.
It's called Project Superpower. So tell everybody a little bit about what they'll be seeing in a month from now.
So this is another one, which was in the era when I'd gone back into comic book shops and was picking stuff up. And I was like, oh, that cover looks cool. But it was somehow
Alex Ross.
Because of that, yeah, exactly. It somehow bridges that world between Golden Age and kind of modern comics. It's a really, and I don't know a lot about the Golden Age, if I'm honest. I'm learning a lot from listening to Matt. But this comic somehow manages to cross over those two worlds. And it is absolutely beautiful to look at. And it is really, really smart. It's not a comic you can half pay attention to. You've got to really be paying attention as you read it.
Yeah, we're going to do volume one, which is issues 0 through 7. So everybody get on that. It's on Hoopla Digital if you don't have that. Hoopla Digital, the official support comic, official app of Indie Comic Spotlight. Get on that. So we're going to do that. So thank you, friend, for doing this. This is exciting. I hope
we continue. It's a good start, I think.
Yes. So we're going to leave the Buffyverse and we're going to go into superheroes. That's very exciting. Yeah. So where can everybody find you on the interwebs besides on the Comics Emotion Network? Of course
on the Comics Emotion Network. But I'm most active on Twitter and it's I am Jack's Musings. That's J-A-C-S. And then that will allow you to see all my random musings, funnily enough, on everything that I watch and read, whether it's for myself, whether it's because I'm listening to somebody's podcast, or whether it's because I'm introducing my kids to it. Yeah.
Nice. Excellent. Well, you guys can follow me on Twitter at Tricycle Boombox or go to my website, arfarina.com, and you can send me a message there. If you have an idea, I have an idea that I'm going to pitch to Jack once we hit end recording for what to do in 2 months from now. But if you know what you want, if you're like, you know, what's a cool indie comic we want to hear Jack and Tony talk about, send me a message, send Jack a message. We'll put it on the list. Jack's list.
Yeah, please.
He's got a whole gift. I'll put it on the list. And he's even wearing his Captain America shirt today.
I am. The list is so unwieldy and long. But please add to it because I just want to experience as much as I can.
Absolutely. So very cool. Well, thank you, friend. And we will see everybody in a month. Bye now.
Take care.